Everyone, and welcome back to season four of the Fudidashi podcast, where Lauren is making a game too, but she's making a game professionally. I'm making a game non-professionally for myself, hopefully for other people as well.
And it'll so be professional once it starts making you money, right?
So yeah, once my Steam application finally goes through, which is taking forever, hopefully I'll be able to actually sell it for American and dollars and other currencies. But today, specifically, I wanted to talk about the mechanics of my game, and then also sort of like the way in which mechanics sort of structure the, I guess you could say, more sensual aspects of of player engagement with a game. So like, you know, desire is something I want to talk about today.
We're using the word desire, and I love how you're like the more sensual aspects of game development. It's more about that feeling of joy, right? Or that feeling of like frustration, right? That you get after engaging, right? With the game of your choosing, right?
And the reason why this came up is because I was listening to a slightly more famous podcast than ours, which is the Triple Click podcast. And they were talking about friction, this concept that sort of floats around game dev at various times in relationship to the recent release of Dragon's Dogma 2. God, I can't talk today. Which is a game I have not played, but Lauren has played, so she will be filling everybody in on the deets. What interested me more about the discussion that the three of them had was the way in which they sort of talked about how this concept of friction as sort of like, how should we explain this? Like the constellation of challenges or impediments, or broadly speaking, that, you know, when you're playing a game, there is a thing you want to get out of that game, but the game itself in many ways functions as something that sort of like stands in between you and what you want to get out of it, whether that's some form of like excitement or sensual pleasure or just the joy of solving a puzzle or whatever sort of emotional and visceral response that you have that you sort of like are seeking in playing a game, even if that response is like just like to chill out or to calm down or relax or whatever. Like all of those things are equally valid forms of sort of like, for lack of a better term, like pleasure seeking behavior. And what kind of frustrated me a little bit in the way in which these other very fine podcasters, I'm not trying to take them down. Like, it's a very good episode. You should go listen to it.
It's a really excellent episode. And I think here, whenever we reference other podcasts, like the impetus should be to go listen to other people, right? Because we're all professionals. Even if we're not doing this for, say, pay, we are all developing professional skills that can be, you know, solicited by other paying professionals of the business corporate world. I think for me, the biggest thing is recognizing that, like, whenever we talk about things that you start going into friction, desire, motivations for play, why you do things, like you're getting into a very interesting, almost kind of viscerally academic space or theoretical space, at least, right?
Yeah.
And I think here on the Furudashi podcast, we've tried to kind of combine the theoretical approach with the actual practical approach. And here, this is something that Nicholas is actually working on, making a game that is kind of full of friction. And so
maybe,
I
started to think that maybe I'm making an anti-friction game.
Game. Yeah. And so I think what's going to be really interesting is like to go kind of talk about some of what people could consider like unnecessary friction, as I think when people start to talk about it, because the game in of itself is getting so much in my way right? Or the chasm between me and my wants is so unfathomable. How dare you that now I can go to Reddit and complain about it? Versus there are lots of friction moments in games that I think we don't ever really consider as like friction, right? Players of Resident Evil are going to go, ah, the inventory management, but then they're going to still play Resident Evil and just be like, ah, inventory management. But that's actually a very interesting, what could be considered a pain point, right, for users.
No, and that's a really good point, because I think the assumption, generally speaking, is that you have sort of like desires and goals and things that you want out of a play experience, and that somehow challenges are actually distinct from them and also stand in the way of them. That's sort of like the classic conception. Like there's something that you want, the challenge then stands in between the thing that you want and yourself. I actually want to posit that that's wrong. That's actually fundamentally wrong. Because of the many ways in which these sorts of impediments are sort of like whatever kind of obstacle you can imagine, be it like sort of like an in-game challenge or whatever, like that is actually part of the structure of how desire is formed in these contexts. I'll explain what I mean. So for imagine you had the ability to like, okay, hunger. Hunger is a good example of how this works. So the longer you delay eating, as when after you first get hungry, what happens? Do you just like, does your hunger like stay the same? No, it increases. Like the delay in gratification of your hunger, this feeling that you have, actually magnifies it. And so that's what I mean. Like the impediment, the not eating or the having to delay eating, is actually increasing and maybe even transforming the nature of that desire for food. And when I say transforming the nature of that desire, think about the way in which a lot of people get when they start to get really hungry. Like their entire mood changes as a result. Similarly, when you're playing a really difficult game, like when you're playing a Souls game or basically insert any From Software game here, like as things become more difficult, but not necessarily, they don't necessarily stop you. In other words, it's becoming harder and harder, but you're still continuing to do it. Like that tension that builds up in you, that when you do finally succeed and you have that sort of cathartic release, that feels a whole hell of a lot different than if you had just sort of like breezily slid through every single challenge in the game. And so then if that's, go ahead.
No, I was going to say like something that you really mentioned here is there is in neurology or the study of like neurological development in humans, there is this intrinsic link between motivation and desire. I'm going to absolutely butcher this, but if you want to kind of dig into that and then kind of get a little bit freaked out about the, you know, kind of two sides of the same coin of pleasure and pain, you can look at Andrew Huberman's podcast specifically about how to basically increase your motivation and drive as it relates neurologically to kind of the synapses in your brain. And something that Nicholas mentions is about, you know, hunger, right? Is that it's very easy for us to think that I really enjoy eating or I really love eating because we get that pleasure of the first bite. But it has been scientifically proven that after eating one bite of something, because you have it again on repeat exposure, your pleasure goes down and down and down. Yep. And so I think what's interesting is the same way with challenge and video game design. Right? As soon as you learn the mechanics, you get the tutorial, nothing feels the best than defeating that first boss. But now you need to seek out more and more challenge. You need to seek out greater and greater challenge. Likewise, especially for if you're a foodie like myself, you now need to seek out more and more interesting flavors. And it's because, right, that threshold for, I'm going to use the word pain tolerance and pleasure tolerance here, but please note that I am butchering a neurological concept that is actually very biological, right? Is that my desire, right, for tastier and tastier food is only because I have once had tasty food, right? And then you can see now that my drive and my motivation is not so much actually because I want to experience that pleasure. It's actually because I want to avoid the pain of not eating something delicious. And I think that's really interesting when we look at it now translating it into the game design, right? Is that the boredom associated with just hitting enemies and defeating bosses at my level isn't giving me, right, the desire of something that now is giving me that sweet, sweet juice of like a boss well defeated in a From Software game, right? Yes. So I just like, I grind, I hit the people, but it's not that it's not that it's painful, right? Like I'm still getting something out of it, but it's not neurologically, right, ticking that pleasure box. It's not as cool to kill all the grunts. I'm looking for the high-end boss, right?
Yeah.
And especially in an AI companion game, what do you probably do in Dragon's Dogma? You probably look at all the trash and you're like, who's the hardest boss in this AI, right, sim to kill? Because you've got three other people that can take out the trash. Yeah. Like that's the metaphor. Now, as a PvP person, I am the take out the trash person because I get plenty of joy just not dying. And I want to like avoid the pain of death as much as possible. And that gives me joy. So I think it was really interesting as we dig into friction versus potentially making an anti-friction game. I think that it'll be really interesting for us to kind of draw those parallels between motivation and desire. And that concept that the desire for something is really actually just to avoid the pain of not having that. Very fascinating stuff. Definitely go take a listen once again to that Andrew Huberman podcast that I've just been, I don't know, I've just been really enjoying because it's not related to video game development and it's completely foreign to anything that I do. And so it's been really like, it's been really relaxing to listen to that. And sometimes I hear a dog on the other end and I'm like, oh, there's a dog in the background. So it's been fun. Anyway, back to actual video game development and the nature of that.
Well, what you're saying makes sense also because then it would explain, I think having a this is going to sound strange, having a pleasure-centric approach to game design also will then help you understand the importance of variety. Because it's not just that things are boring because they're not challenging enough, but like you could have a particular kind of boss fight that is super difficult to execute mechanically. But then if you do it again and then again and then again and then again, that'll be just as boring as if you had like varying levels of like actual sort of like, you know, twitch mechanics that you had to execute. And the reason why, I mean, sort of the hunger analogy can help explain this, because the thing is, even though I'm not necessarily like this for most people, they can't really eat the same thing over and over and over and over and over again, regardless of how well it's made, how well seasoned, how well prepared, how like perfectly executed, because there's complex like physiological reasons for this. But the point is that the way our sort of like our whole psychosomatic system works is that your person, yourself, seeks out a degree of variety in pleasures, because pleasure is intimately tied to like our physiological needs as well. Like they can't really be easily divorced from one another. And so then when you engage in pleasure seeking behaviors in a game, like, you know, one day you might want to play a really involved RPG, or next day you might want to just play a dating sim. The next day you might want to play, I don't know, just like a puzzle game. And the reason for that is because the greater variety and the greater diversity you get in these experiences, the more stimulating they are for you. Not just because of sort of that sense of delayed gratification, but also because it's like how should I put this? Because it's not you're training your brain. It's actually your brain doing it to you in many ways.
No, but it also is actually you training your brain. And so this is like, once again, like something super fascinating that I'm learning about. And it's kind of crazy to think about, because I kind of came from psychology. I came from English literature, right? I came from kind of fan theory and Foucault and philosophy, and was like, ooh, look at all these philosophical ways you can know thyself. Sorry, that has nothing to do with what we actually did, Nicholas. It was much cooler than that.
Thank you for making my class seem less dumb than it was.
No, the class was fantastic, everybody. And I kind of wish that he would just put it up on some sort of teaching platform so I could take it all over again. I'm not actually kidding. I absolutely loved your class, and I need to go back. Anyway, sorry, that is a tangent, everybody. I'm chasing the desire of novelty and trying to pressure my friend into make coursework for money. Okay, that's not actually novel. He's probably tired of hearing it. Where was I? Let me. Okay, now that we've reversed the tape, this is what's really fascinating to me when we look at friction and we look at desire, is because this is why rewards work. And it's why I always talk about, if you want to be a game designer, right, kind of like learn about people, right? Yeah. Because you're making an experience, you're making entertainment for people. And there is a lot of research about how to make a really good film, right? And film and books, right, are a structure for storytelling that just everyone understands, right? A book is a big block of text and you read it. But are you making like a mystery novel, right? You're probably going to use different formulas, right? Are you making a, I'm going to continue on the mystery thread with like, are you making a noir film, right? Yeah. Are you making Art Nouveau? Like, does that make sense? All of these things have labels. And we're still in this period of game design where we now have more labels, right? Like Dragon's Dogma 2 is definitely something that feels kind of like From Software, but also feels like a big Witcher kind of RPG.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that even like role-playing game has is too broad of a term now, because yeah. Like, why are you role playing? What role are you playing? Right? Is the game about the role you're playing, or really is this just a fancy way of saying, you know, it's a social game and like there's dialogue choice, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's all really fascinating. So it's a little bit, that was a little bit of a tangent, but the bullet of this was like, this is how rewards work. This is why you chase those novels experiences. And it's also why activity designers, especially in something like Destiny 2, is now a title, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's all about creating activities that players want to repeat in over and over again. And also, if you're really, really curious about, you know, the gamification, I mean, of life, this is why dieting works. Right? It's why you can be like, man, I'm craving celery sticks now, because you have gone without, right? Say sweets or something. So yeah. That is a bit of a tangent, but I just wanted to kind of bullet it with like, when we are now diving into the friction design and we're diving into some of those examples or what anti-friction looks like, I think it'll be really interesting to figure out like that challenge metric, that reward metric, right? And kind of look at ways in which like, yeah, just kind of look at ways in which you are living your life already from that reward-centric approach, right? That pleasure-centric approach that Nicholas is talking about here.
So I would say that, okay, we've been a little bit too abstract here. So let me use a concrete example. The example I was originally going to use was a game by some friends of ours, and I wish it were much more popular than it is, but it's not. So I'm going to use the most famous game of 2023, which is Baldur's Gate 3. And the reason why is because that game can help us see the way in which sort of like the structure of like how you elicit pleasures sort of aesthetically and how you sort of like delay gratification, what forms of gratification you're delaying, is then mapped onto narrative progression in the game. And so this is a similar thing that could be said for Dragon's Age and sort of the way the romances with like the various characters work there. But if you think about like when you're romancing a companion in Baldur's Gate 3, like it's very diffuse because something relevant to your relationship with a character can happen at any time. And again, this is true of games like Dragon's Age as well. But the thing is, what exactly is it that is sort of like the reward? What is the sensual reward in interacting with these companions? And for me, this kind of became clear, at least for me personally and my weird predilections, in explaining why it is that I found Shadowheart very boring. I found romancing her very boring, and I found it really easy, and I didn't really like it. Whereas the whole like romantic structure with Minthara, and I don't want to talk about what this says about me personally, I found far more compelling and far more interesting. And what's interesting is that in each case, like their reward structures are inverted, because the thing that you would think of as like the final culmination of a relationship, like an actual romantic / sexual encounter with the companion of your choice, in Minthara's case happens at the beginning. Like, it's actually very easy to have sex with her as a result of like whatever decision you make with regards to the Druid Grove in Act One. It's very difficult though to get to know her and to find out things about her, about her motivations. And in many ways, well, even though romancing Solas is different from romancing Minthara, but like the pleasure of romancing both of those characters in my mind, like either Solas in Dragon's Age Inquisition or Minthara in Baldur's Gate 3, is that in each case, the reward, the sensual reward, is what you discover about them. And the reason why that's important is because then the progress of that discovery is then mapped onto the narrative progression of the game as a whole. And so, like, a basic game system, like the sort of like the design of the narrative structure of the game, is then being mirrored through the way in which you interact with the companions. And because that mirroring, you may not necessarily recognize it like consciously, but you are recognizing it subconsciously. And so then as a result, like finding out things about these characters in tidbits, little bits of moments of progression, the rise and fall, especially in the Solus romance, which I'm not going to spoil, but like
you shouldn't spoil it, even if
very, very, very upsetting happens. Like, I'll just put it that way. And so as a result, like the highs and lows that occur, like, you don't get all of that all at once. It's not like there's actually a bad example of this in Baldur's Gate 3. And that's the sort of like the romance with the Emperor, where like literally you find out all about him in this like massive like cutscene lore dump. And it's like, here he is. This is the guy. That's who he is. And it's like, okay, that wasn't very compelling. But the thing is, in order to find out about a character like Minthara, and actually this is somewhat true of Shadowheart as well, although I just find that what you find out about Shadowheart to be not that interesting. But you have to seek after it, and you have to sort of navigate what like they're telling you and also what you want to get from them. And so like there are gameplay mechanics there. I mean, yeah, sure, it's just like, you know, choosing dialogue options, but you have to be responsive to what they're saying to you, as well as to, like, to your own desires to sort of like get to know them and do things in game that they would approve of, so that these dialogue options can be made available to you so that you can progress in finding out, you know, more about them. And so then the true pleasure there is in the revelation of who they are to you, not, in my mind, the, you know, sexy time. Like, sexy time is fine. I like sexy time too, don't get me wrong. Like, I'm not,
yeah,
I'm,
I was
not
gonna say, like, how many jokes can we make about, how many jokes can we or other people have made about like friction and desire?
Friction and desire, and yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I love that. And like, kind of taking it back away from like the romance options, I think what's really compelling there is you mentioned about how you need to listen to both what they're saying, right, and also kind of what they say or how they act, right, based on the examples of the player's actions or choices that they're making within this role play game, right? I think what's really interesting here is that there's this active listening, right? This active involvement that players will need to have on a cerebral level in order to really make the correct dialogue choices, right? I say cerebral only because even in a lot of like past RPG examples, like Dragon Age Inquisition also semi-suffers from this in some of their, not suffers, I am perfectly happy to have romanced Cullen in one of my mini playthroughs and very much was like, cookie, 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 Cullen, right? Like, I very much was just like, give the man a cookie and then realize he has a very sad backstory and learn about his life and then be like really sad because I was romancing him for a joke, but then suddenly I fall for him and then I was like, fuck, you got me. This is exactly what I was supposed to do.
Yeah.
And now I'm upset. And then I also romance Solus. So that's my personality in a nutshell. I think that what's really interesting here is that it's that active engagement, right? And I think that as we move into your game and talking about ways that you are trying to actively engage your players, I absolutely think that this is going to provide kind of what we talk about friction and we talk about that challenge, right?
Yeah.
I think in Minthara's romance and Solus's romance, both of them weren't particularly challenging. Right. And I also
it's not difficult.
Right. And it's not about, and that's why I'm saying, right, it's not about difficult. So when we look at challenge, right, we look at like obstacles. I do think that Solus was one of those romance options that you had many opportunities to flirt with him. Yeah. But the one flirt moment that actually defined if you romanced or not was like kind of took place in a very like a dreamscape. Let's just call it that. Right?
Yeah.
Kind of out of context of the rest of the world. And it was that thing that was special that you didn't know made you special is actually kind of the biggest tell of all for Solus of why he even became interested in you anyway, despite the fact that you were, you know, specifically female and also specifically elf, right? It was oh, it was that. And like,
well, it also helps explain his particular character arc and where it ends up. Like that moment.
It does. But, yeah. But you don't realize it at the time, right? It exactly, is a revelation, yeah. Exactly, yeah. Right? And so I think it's the revelations, right, that kind of make some of these dialogue choice options. Or when we talk about RPGs here and we talk about narrative progression, it's so involved in these properties because it's like right up in your face. And you kind of players, I think, more and more with Baldur's Gate 3, I wouldn't be surprised if in Dragon Age 4, it kind of takes from that and requires you to listen to your party banter and requires you, right, to listen to what kind of the world, right, wants you to do. And then you probably, right, will make choices about, well, I don't want to do that, or I do want to do that, or, you know, grayness is amazing in the Dragon Age games. I mean, grayness is amazing in, you know, Baldur's Gate 3. Gray being, it's not as simple as binary like Mass Effect, right?
Yeah.
So I only bring that up because it's in your face. And I think that's as we transition to Nicholas's game, yours is also in your face.
Yeah. So the reason,
it's there.
Yeah, the reason why earlier I was saying that I think I suspect I might be making an anti-friction game, or to put it more specifically, a game that challenges the idea of friction in the first place, is because in the game there is this tension between, okay, so if you behave in the typical way that, like, you know, you behave in a game where, like, you're supposed to, like, defy people and you're supposed to, like, fight against and struggle and do all of these things that are very typical of, like, what you do in modern video games, that's actually going to get you in hot water very quickly. Because in many ways, both what the two characters who are in your head, who are, like, talking to you in a sense the entire time, what they want from you, and also then implicitly what the game wants from you as a player, is to let go, is to actually stop being defiant, stop trying to like fight everything, stop trying to struggle against all odds. And the way the game achieves this is that it won't give you the narrative unless you do that. The more you try to struggle, the more you try to resist, the more you try to assert yourself, the less narrative you get. And so there's this weird way in which sort of like it is a form of friction, but it's weird because it's almost like a perverted form of friction, because it's not necessarily an obstacle. It's like telling you that you need to remove your own personal obstacles. You need to remove your own preconception of how this is supposed to play out. Because if you don't, you just die. You just literally you die.
I think what's interesting is I was going to ask actually about this because you have a lot of defiance, and we actually talked about defiance a lot. And yes. So I think what's really interesting is in these next couple few episodes, I wonder if we should talk about acceptance.
Yes.
Because I wonder if that what you just talked about with like the friction or the challenge, that the obstacle is yourself and you need to kind of remove, I don't want to say yourself from the equation, but the character themselves, right? Needs to remove themselves. I'm curious, is that still a paradigm of, right, are you anti-friction or did you just place the friction somewhere else?
Well, I think the reason why I characterize it as a kind of, maybe not perversion, especially since we're talking about pleasure, an inversion, in the same way that like, for example, Minthara's character arc is kind of an inversion. In other words, like the stereotype of what you consider to be the reward is foregrounded so that like the narrative progression with her can reveal that what was actually important was something else. And so in many ways, it's like what the game presents you with is the stereotype of how friction is supposed to work in a game, how challenge is supposed to work. But you actually have to see past that in order to understand what the challenge of the game actually is. And I think you're right. The challenge of the game is learning acceptance. And that's very, and I don't want to say that I've achieved that because I don't actually know. But I feel like if I can achieve that, if I can figure out a way to represent to my player this idea that what you should be doing is coming to grips with something in the sense of like, you know, because every game I make is in some way, shape or form kind of about myself. And a lot of the things that I've been struggling with in the past couple of years of my life has to do with recognizing that I have to let go of a lot of the habits that I have built up over time because they're extremely self-destructive. And so for this particular character, Ohatsu, in the game, these very noble things that she tried to do in her life were ultimately self-destructive. And right. So the whole like retrospective structure of the game is meant not just for her to sort of like reflect in this kind of aloof sense, but reflection as a means of sort of accepting the reality of what happened to her. And that maybe the way she understood it in the moment wasn't necessarily good for her or good for the people around her, even if she thought it was right and good and true, which from a moral standpoint, much of it is. That's hard. Like, that's a really hard thing to accept.
No, that's a really hard thing, I think. I think it speaks to a lot of what we're all going through right now with trying to, I mean, hell, even with just the pandemic, like, accept that things aren't going to go back to the way they were. But also in the games industry writ large, kind of accepting that the industry itself is in a period of not only like destructive turmoil, but like you mentioned, a lot of the bad habits that we as developers have, with work being our entire life, with literally redesigning our homes around being able to have a job, yeah. Right? A place of safety is now a place of stress,
exactly,
right?
Yeah.
So I think what's really interesting here is that like you have a really strong theme that only now are we really starting to talk about acceptance. And so I'm curious, what is probably the first mechanic that comes to mind when you think about trying to teach, right, Ohatsu or yourself, right, that acceptance in the game?
Well, it's in many ways, it sort of is there in the basic structure of how the choices work. Because the thing is, we talked previously a little bit about sort of the fact that like the narrative side of my brain wanted to have a relatively like cohesive, straightforward path for the player to take. But then there needed to be along the way a certain degree of latitude, and that I wasn't doing enough, at least initially, I thought, to sort of engender that latitude. So one of the things that I did very early on is that I completely redid how the game starts. And so the game starts with probably the most fundamental choice of all. Are you actually going to play this fucking game? And in fact, it gives you the chance to just not. It gives you the choice, very explicitly, to say, no, I'm not going to do what I'm supposed to do. Fuck you. You can't tell me anything. And if you do, and if you make that choice, the game will kill you. Well, it'll kill your character. It won't kill you.
This isn't Sword Art Online.
This is not a horror film that we're making where the game has like feedback. Whoa. And it like murders you.
I'm not doing that.
But the point is that the character dies and the game's over. Like, it's actually very easy to complete the game. You can just refuse to play it, sort of. But if you choose to play it,
that is like my new mentality. Like, it's really easy to play this game. You could just not.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, games don't usually get, I mean, it comes off as a little gimmicky, I'm willing to admit that, but for me, it's sort of the moment that says, okay, this game is going to give you choices that maybe you otherwise wouldn't normally have, and the reward for making those choices is to, instead of just getting sort of like the linear progression of the narrative, to get the sort of the fleshed out, like the widening of the narrative. And this then sort of like made me think recently about something that I had done almost like autonomically when I was coding everything, which is that I had done this typical thing where I had restricted the player from being able to go back and make like different choices as you go along, because that's in the basic functionality of RenPy, is the ability to sort of go back and sort of repeat things. I had restricted that, but then I was like, wait, why am I restricting that? If the whole point of this game is to then sort of see the multiple paths, to see the multiple perspectives, then mechanically I should actually be allowing my player to do this. If they want, they shouldn't have to engage in some sort of like elaborate save scum like scheme in order to be able to see sort of like the way in which the broadening of the narrative works, to see all the various like perspectives on a particular moment. I want you to see all of those perspectives, and I don't necessarily think you need to like do it as a function of like a full playthrough. Because if what I say is true, that Ohatsu's character is sort of looking at all this retrospectively and sort of coming to grips with like the many things in her life, sort of the many things that each moment in her life could mean, then that means that for me as the designer, I have to let the player do that. If those two things are going to map onto each other, the player has to have a similar degree of latitude in reflecting on their own in-game decisions and actions that Ohatsu would have at this point in her life at the very end.
So when you're looking at those two things that need to map together, really briefly summarize, what exactly are those two things that our listeners should be like looking at for in your game?
I would say, don't think of a playthrough of my game as being like, say, an honor mode run in Baldur's Gate 3. If you make a particular choice and you're like, oh, crap, what resulted from that was something that made me feel not great and I'm not particularly fond of like the choice that I made now, just go back and redo it. Just go back and redo it. Why? And so this is what I mean by sort of like Ohatsu's perspective maps onto yours as the player. If we assume, as I'm trying to sort of like communicate through the game, that the thing that Ohatsu has to learn is that like the choices that she made in her life didn't necessarily have to be that way. Two, didn't necessarily mean what she thought they meant. Then that means mechanically, so if she's expected to go back and look at her own life experience again in these fundamentally different ways, then you two as the player mechanically get to go back through the narrative and look at those moments again, making different choices and seeing different results. The sort of the long arc of the narrative will still be the same, but the way you feel about what happens and the way you sort of understand what happens will then shift. It won't shift. That's not what I mean to say. It will expand. Because the thing is that the first choice you make and the thing that results is true. But if you go back and you make a different choice and you get a different result, that is also true. If you succeed in a particular dialogue encounter, that is true. If you fail, that is also true. These things are not mutually exclusive. And the reason go ahead.
No, go ahead. You should actually complete your thought because you were about to say the reason why. And so that might answer my question. So go ahead.
The reason why these are all true is because that's the way memory works. Memory isn't necessarily like a factual recounting of events. One of the things that we do in our brains as a result of, say, like things like traumatic experiences, or just like, you know, thinking about what happened to you previously and then having a different perspective on it, we sort of like edit and flesh out both what the experience was and also what it means. And so that's it. Because the structure of this whole game is through memory, then for me, the reason why both of those results are true is because they would be true in a memory as well. Like, or like, even if you think of it as, you know, you go back to an earlier moment in your life, say like when you're a teenager and you think of something really stupid that you did, like, what if I had done it differently? What would result? That reflection itself, even though it's not quote unquote what happened, is true for you emotionally because it reflects something about yourself. In the same way that like if you sort of flesh out the various branching paths at a given time in the game, the given moment in the game, you are sort of like expanding upon what is true for you and your play experience and expanding upon what is true for Ohatsu and sort of her reflections.
So this is also something we haven't talked about, but now that I've kind of listened to these types of things and I asked for like a specific mechanic, I think that you kind of answered originally with player choice. Right, yeah. That initial player choices, and it's the types of choices players make, right? So while dialogue choice is your obvious like main mechanic, there isn't, say, anything under the hood that's kind of, that's a system, right? There is this kind of system for combat under the hood with defiance scores that maybe we can get into next episode.
Yeah.
But for now, I'm actually super curious. It sounds like kind of one of your main gameplay tenets was actually about replaying the game.
Yeah, but not necessarily replaying in like the classic way. You don't have to like go from beginning to end and then replay from beginning to end and then replay from beginning to end. In many ways, the replay function is sort of like you can rewind, so to speak. Like you can rewind a little bit, play it again, rewind a little bit, play it again. And so then you can have one play through from like beginning to end, but then within that playthrough, you can have various recursive moments. And in fact, as many recursive moments as you want to have, you can do it as many times as you want.
So the one thing that I do want to like mention here is I actually haven't played the latest version of your game, lo siento. But when you say that you're able to replay it through, you also actually earlier along mentioned that you didn't want to have saves coming. So is that, do you have like that rewind function now to be like beep and you go back?
Yeah, it's in there. Yeah, okay. It's in there
now.
Yeah,
that's what I thought. I was like, that sounds like you actually do have that rewind.
Yeah, no, the whole point was is that like I had assumed that I needed to sort of prevent that from happening, but I hadn't actually challenged myself and my own preconceptions about how like those gameplay mechanics reflected the theme of the game. Because once I actually did that, once I took the time to think it through, I realized actually those two things are in like direct opposition to each other. And that maybe I should give up on this idea that you're supposed to like impose a particular degree of challenge by making choices sort of unredoable. And that,
yeah, I think that's really interesting. I can see actually now why in the next like kind of like 5 to 10 minute wrap up we do here, we should talk about this kind of anti-fraction methodology, because you also were a user experience user interface designer and kind of one of the key tenets of UI design. And I'm going to use UI and UX here and the traditional, this is a dumb word.
Since games the olden times.
Since the olden times, that's a bad word. We're going to start this over. Since in, you know, standard modernized UI UX design, sometimes a lot of when you look at app and mobile app development particularly or web development, it's all about eliminating friction. You want as least amount of clicks as possible. And the same is true in tools design and workflow management for say writing and game development, right? Is that you want the least amount of friction between a writer and the writing as possible, right? So if you have to go through like 50 different menus just to get to a place where you can enter text, you can see why after that a writer would be like, okay, I'm going to leave the editor running. Well, if you let the editor hang too long, now you can't write and you've got to go through it again.
Yeah.
Right? So eliminating friction is something that is actually kind of a tenet, right? Of UI UX design and of tools design. So I think what's really interesting here is it sounds like you're anti-friction because you're like, look, a friction of, say, a traditional roguelike, right, or rogue, is you're going to play through the whole story, and then once you die, everything's gone, and now try again. But that's like intentional friction because that's the purpose of rogue, right? It wants you to continue to start at level zero. But for yourself, you actually found that you wanted players to be able to replay the choice, but kind of the choices in that moment, like reading a book. I just need to reread this next page. I just need
to.
Yeah.
And so, and the reason for that, I guess you're right. Maybe it is sort of like the UX designer in me coming through. I mean, I have a lot of problems with sort of like frictionless design in UX. Strangely, like in UX design, I have a problem with it, but in game design, I don't have a problem with it. So I don't know what that says.
I think you value nonconformity, and I think that's a great value to have. True change can only come from not conforming.
Well, but the value in being nonconformist in that particular way is to sort of tell both. In both cases, it's still fundamentally user-centric. It's player-centric because it's looking at yourself not just as a designer, but as a player, as maybe sort of like the first player or like the best player, the player that you can know best. And so being honest with yourself about like, say, this is sort of like my broad, this is the lesson to leave you with. Being honest with yourself about what you like and what sort of like compels you will then also help lead you into thinking about what will compel like your players, because they are human beings in the same way that you are a human being. And if you be honest, and that's really the important point, is that don't just like repeat some conventional mode of doing things that you have been taught or that you picked up from playing, you know, years and years and years of games. Actually be honest with yourself about what you like, how you like to do it, and then think about the ways in which what you want out of a game can then be mapped on to what you have your player do. And so I think with that, we're at the roughly 45-minute mark. It's a little short of that, but a couple of sort of things to close you all with. First of all, I wanted to let you all know that we have a Substack. It's gamedesigndiscourse.substack.com, where I usually sort of write out some of my thoughts about the things that we have discussed in this episode, maybe tangents that I cut because we want the episode to be coherent. And so a lot of that information you will find on gamedesigndiscourse.com. We also have a Patreon, patreon.com/foodidashi, where I am currently putting out a series on Jesse Schell's The Art of Game Design. I think we're on chapters 11 through 12 will be the next one that comes out. Also, all of our backlog of bonus episodes are there. Also, our previous Furidashi Classroom series are there as well. So for $5 a month, you can sign up for that. You can get a lot of really amazing content. Is there anything else that you want to mention, Lauren, before we go?
No, I think you pretty much summed it up. I really loved ending on how user experience design has kind of influenced you in this, but also at the end of the day, like figuring out how to make that mechanical adjustment to your own process in kind of rewind versus replay was really interesting to hear, particularly so that I can go back and now like replay, but also use rewind as that example. Right. Yeah. For the rest of you lovely folks out there, like, don't forget, please subscribe to us on Patreon, like us on Twitter. I will never use that other word until I guess I get canceled because I'm using the word Twitter. And until next time, just keep on clocking on.